listening to the Grit City Podcast.
Now here are your hosts, two drunk ass white boys with a microphone, Rogan and Scott.
Story of Jake Bird is as good as it gets when it comes to creepy stories about the gritty city. It is often referred to in serial killer circles as the most famous serial killer you've never heard of. Sit back, sip a beverage or blaze up one, and prepare for the true story of Jake Bird. This is a story that involves a curse that actually comes true. I'll start from the very beginning. Jake Bird was born in Louisiana in 1901 and had a relatively troubled life from the start. He left home at the age of 19 to seek his fortune riding the rails of America. He was a hobo day laborer, traveling the nation and trading a day's work for a night's sleep and a warm meal wherever he stopped. He would reportedly kill with savage swings of an axe or a knife before hopping on the rails on his way to another town. But we'll get to that later. He was otherwise unremarkable wherever he went, just one of the faces in the growing crowd of what was called Grandy Dancers, which were rail-hopping day laborers at that time. But that would change when it came to the end of the line in Tacoma. The city of destiny, after all, was the terminus for the Transcontinental Railroad, a fact that coined that term, end of the line. His story of stardom started on October 30th, 1947. Bird was 45. He was looking for work and came across the home of Bertha Clute and her daughter, Beverly June. He hacked them to death with an axe. They screamed during the attack, and the scene was so loud that neighbors called the police. Two police officers arrived, only to find Bird covered in blood, still holding a knife and an axe, as he was running from the scene. They cornered him, so he attacked one of the officers, slashing him in the hand while stabbing the other in the shoulder. But they managed to still tackle him and handcuff him with all the genteel love and care that you would expect when an African-American man who had just killed two white women before attacking two police officers in the 1940s. Now, the race of the killer and his victims is an important fact that shapes history later on in the story, so fear not. Anyway, Bird was taken to the hospital for his injuries and then taken in shackles to the old City Hall jail. It was called Siberia because it was so isolated from the rest of the world. It had no windows or light, other than a bare bulb hanging from the vaulted ceilings. It was hot all the time, since it was located on the opposite side of the massive furnace that heated the entire building. Now, I've been there. It is not a happy place now, so I can't imagine what it was like in 1940. Bird's first almost convinced the officers that he was innocent, but the fact that he still had brain matter splattered on his shirt finally convinced the officers that they had their man. He then confessed to the killing, starting with stating that it was a burglary gone bad. He claimed that he had entered the house to steal stuff, but was caught by Bertha. He panicked when she tried to thwart his attack and hit her in the head with an axe. Beverly June, who was just taking an after-school nap, heard the noise, and Bird axed her when she came to rescue her mother. Evidence that Bertha had been raped and that Beverly June was savagely attacked sealed Bird's fate. His trial came a month later. It lasted just 2.5 days. Despite his claims that he signed a confession under duress, his bloody fingerprints and the brain matter made his death sentence almost a foregone conclusion. He was convicted of murder in the first degree after just 30 minutes of jury deliberation. The judge handed down the sentence of death by hanging. This is where the story gets weird. As he was being sentenced, Byrd declared, "I'm putting the hex of Jake Byrd on all of you who had anything to do with me being punished. Mark my words, you will die before I do." Taken at the time as just idle threats from a murderer, the hex didn't get much notice. That is, until people started dying. First, the judge, the Honorable Edward Hodge, died of a heart attack just a month after the sentencing. Then the police officer, Joe Carpatch, who wrote Byrd's first confession, died of a heart attack. Then the court clerk, Ray Scott, died of pneumonia, not a heart attack. Then the police officer who recorded Byrd's second confession, Sherman Lyons, died of a heart attack. Then Byrd's court-appointed defense attorney, who is the former Pierce County prosecuting attorney, J.W. Selden, died of a heart attack on the anniversary of Jake's sentencing. The newspaper reported at the time, "Selden's death came shortly after 2 a.m. in his office at the Puget Sound Bank Building. He was seated at his desk, reading the Supreme Court decisions, when he gasped suddenly and died. With his death, Pierce County officials are asking each other, who's next?" Byrd's prison guard, Arthur A. Stewart, would be that next person. He died of a heart attack. While still alive at Walla Walla's death row, Byrd continued to confess to crimes during his years on the rails. He tallied 44 to his butcher's bill. He provided enough details that 11 of those cases were officially closed. His first kills were reportedly of two women in Illinois in 1942. Other victims were confirmed in Louisville, Kentucky, Omaha, Nebraska, Kansas City, Kansas, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Cleveland, Ohio, Orlando, Florida, and Portage, Wisconsin. Police officers in Houston, Texas, suspect him of murdering a woman there as well. His story would end shortly after midnight on July 15th, 1949, almost 2 years after his last crime. He was 48. He was hanged on the gallows. Some 25 spectators watched the gallows trapdoor snap open, sending Byrd 5 feet down. His neck snapped. His body swung on the rope for 14 minutes before the prison physician pronounced him dead. He was buried in the prison cemetery, identified only by his convict number, number 21520. Byrd's will left his personal fortune of $6.15 to his last attorney handling his appeal. The only two that Jake's hex didn't affect were the actual prosecuting attorney, Pat Steele, and the medical examiner, Charles Larson. In his practice throughout the years, Larson had helped convict about 100 people of murder. A number of these men had threatened to kill him, so Byrd was no different. He actually hadn't heard about the hex until Steele told him about it, but that still didn't faze him. He said, "The desire for revenge is a very immature reaction, as otherwise your average murderer is seldom a very mature, well-rounded character. He was nevertheless subject to the cooling process, the change that comes with the passage of time. Come to think of it, that's how our penal system is all about. Isn't it about putting people on the shelf until they cool off?" I like that thought. Now, an interesting note. The house where Byrd committed his Tacoma crime, it's at 1007 South 21st Street. It's the Burgundy House at the corner of 21st and J Street, just steps away from McCarver Elementary School. That is interesting to people who believe in fate, because while the Byrd case involves matters of race that drew national attention, so did McCarver. It is, after all, the first school designated to reduce racial isolation in public education by offering a choice to parents, when it opted to become what is now known as a magnet school in 1968, 20 years after Bird's rampage literally occurred across the street.
Uber is our new sponsor. They're awesome. They pay us. So please, pretty please, if you're going to use Uber, if you've never used Uber, get online, download it, cheaper, cleaner, faster. Every time I've called them, they've been there under 10 minutes. You can use our code, which is GritCity, one word. It'll get you $20 off your first ride with Uber. And tell your friends. You can use that code. Spread it far and wide.
To the house. It's vacant now, at least seemingly vacant. But I went there writing, doing some research for this. And long before I knew it was going to be part of a podcast, but I just doing it because I like weird stuff. And the residents there were renters, and they didn't know anything about that. So I, you know, flipped the coin in my head. Should I really tell them? And they seemed okay with it, but they didn't know the details. So I walked them through the crime scene of, okay, this is where Bird struck Bertha, and this is where he went upstairs, and this was Beverly June's house, and this is where he killed her with an axe. And then after that, the reports are varied on when he actually raped Bertha, but it would be before or after she had died. But the technology of the 1940s didn't get that specific. So, but the funny thing, or the weird thing, is that the newspapers at the time, they pretty much rewrote everything from the police reports. So everything is in the newspaper. You know exactly how many swings there were, and all the evidence and all that stuff was in the paper, and it made its way around the world.
Yeah. Well, I had forgotten that. I think we even discussed this, probably not even on the podcast, but when you were painting this picture, I was picturing this as a white guy, because serial killers are white people.
They are white men, yes.
They are white males from the Northwest. Speaking,
yes.
Yeah, it's just, so I was like, oh, whoa, he's a black guy. Makes so much more sense now. Like, oh, so, well, that was creepy.
You like that one?
Yeah.
You
I was,
like that one?
Like, oh, good.
Yeah, I was pretty weird.
Now I'm just sitting here going, God damn, I wonder if those people.
Yeah, well, if it was only those two girls, the two women in Tacoma, yeah, you might be like, oh, you know, they just grabbed this guy because he's a transient black dude, right? But he had like 40 others or something that he confessed
44, to. 46.
That's just stupid.
We don't really know because he, you know, much like today, any serial killer who's arrested suddenly confesses to a lot of other things, and then he was apparently very specific on what the details
were.
He could
lay
it out.
He's like, so you're going to find
this
body.
You know enough about these crimes that you were either there or you did it yourself. So they closed 16 of them. So, which would make him the most prolific serial killer known other than Gary Ridgway, who was also of this area. So welcome to the 253.
Yeah.
Of course, it wasn't the 253 at the time.
How did you find out about this?
Well, I'm always into weird history. So you just kind of research it. Some great articles are available in the Tacoma Public Library's Northwest Room, which is also online. Just go to Murray Morgan's History of Tacoma. He's got a roster of, you know, probably 200 essays.
Oh, so there's a place they can go that already have segregated out that information.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, you just type in, you know, Jake Bird, and it's well-documented. There's, you know, at murderpedia.com.
Well, it's freaking me out that this hex, just all these people are just dying from heart attacks. Like, that's really, like, okay, I can even buy up to three of them being kind of a coincidence, but yeah, like, nine people.
Yeah, what a bastard. He murdered people with axes, and then he
murdered
them
with a hex.
Like, that's bullshit. You shouldn't be able to
Voodoo,
do both.
Man. Well, he's born in Louisiana, too. Yeah. I'm from Louisiana. Well, Voodoo is alive and well.
It is it is not something to be taken lightly down in the Big Easy.
No.
Damn.
Jake Bird is a gangster. So he just hopped on the rails, and he was just hoboing around.
Well, you think at the time, you know, there was no need for a passport or driver's license. It'd be just hop on the railroad and go to the next town and, hey, can I spend the night at your house if I mow your lawn or take a, you know, pick up your groceries or whatever? And
murder you with an axe.
And murder you with an axe or whatever.
Hey, do you have an axe?
That was just common at the time. So, you know, people would just go back and forth. And, of course, in Tacoma, it was like I said, the end of the line. So if you can't find a job in Chicago or in some other place, you just
go on
rode,
the next
rode
one.
The rails and you came to Tacoma and can't go any farther. So you found jobs here.
I think it's interesting. There's a jail in the bottom of Old Town Hall.
Well, sure. Why wouldn't there be?
Okay. because I didn't know that, and it just doesn't seem to me that the town hall is the place for the jail, but I guess it was back then.
Yeah, you can see. I'm trying to remember what
that
the...
That is creepy. Kind of weird to think about.
Why is it not in the police station? It's in town hall.
Probably all the same deal back then.
Yeah,
right?
It's all the same building at the time.
Yeah, stupid Brogan. God.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Get your dicks.
Sorry, man.
Okay. But yeah, there's been a couple of movies that were set in that jail cell. And I'm trying to remember... Wires Crossed, David Graham's movie. I could figure it out, but yeah, that had a image of what it was like, and it was exactly the way you would think. A big, you know, 6-inch thick iron door with a little window with iron bars over it, and you walk in, and there's a concrete slab of where you would put a roll-up mattress and a bare bulb hanging from the ceiling that you can't reach.
You can't even turn it off. You just have to lay there and stare at it.
And it was so incredibly hot because...
It's bullshit. You know, fuck jail.
The furnace, the furnace is probably 10 by 20 foot, you know, coal furnace.
Yeah, a big-ass furnace.
Big-ass furnace. So on the other side of that wall is the jail.
Well, yeah, and it was back in the day coal, too, right? So they were shoveling shit in like a big fucking fire.
Yeah,
it
wasn't there was a guy that was his job, was every 45 minutes go down there and throw a heaping wad of coal in there.
Well, and that's one of the stories of Gus, the old City Hall ghost. If you ever want to know about City Hall ghosts, the most prolific story is the story of Gus, who was the janitor there.
Well, as we get closer to Halloween, we're going to warm up. We're gonna put you to the task.
Oh, are you holding that one off? You're like, wait, don't say that one. Until
well, you can lay a little bit of it. You can give us a teaser. Okay. But I'm just thinking that I think
we could do
more and more ghost stuff.
Oh, I've got the ghost stories. I've got the ghost stories, yeah. But one of the stories, the variations of Gus' story, is that he was a janitor at Old City Hall, and he was cleaning out the coal furnace, and it accidentally tripped on, so he was burned alive inside the coal furnace.
That's like the Freddy Krueger origin, right? Wasn't he thrown in the furnace at the school and burnt?
Yeah,
or something?
But that was a bunch of parents that ganged up and threw his ass.
Those
in
there. Bastards.
Like, well, he was
just a bad PTA meeting.
Like I said, there's various versions of who Gus was, but
is there a verification that Gus was ever a real person? Was there an August?
Oh, yeah.
So what else has been going on, man?
What else is going on? Pythian Lodge is going well. Monday nights, 6:00. The Eye of the Totem. I'll give you an update on that. Eye of the Totem.
I watched the trailer.
You saw the trailer. It's working its way around the interwebs. It's already been refurbished, and the film is gorgeous. So I'm really excited about that. They couldn't find the original score, so they had to commission a Tacoma composer to rescore the silent movie.
Oh, that's cool.
What a great
he did an amazing job. You could not tell that it's not out of sync with the time. As historically accurate, inspired as it could be.
That's awesome.
Could not tell that it was not the original score, but we can't tell it's not because we don't know what the score
was. What's that guy's name?
Like.
Give him a plug.
I don't remember offhand.
Well, shit. Google it.
The project is already funded, but they're really, and I think that this is sort of brilliant that they're doing this, because they're not talking about a whole lot of money, but they want, you know, the community to buy in on this absolutely cool project of, you know, restoring this nationally released film set in Tacoma with Tacoma landmarks all over the place. They want people to sort of have ownership in it. So
they should
starting a Kickstarter thing and funding it that way.
Well, think about that. Like, there's this old piece of film. They've made it. It's beautiful. Nobody else is doing that. I don't ever get exposed to old movies that somebody else found. That's an opportunity to get that back out into the world and help Tacoma, help old... Like, what happens? So this works out. Everything works out great. Somebody else has got an old movie from Omaha or somewhere else, and then that's just so rich for a community.
Well, and that's exactly what's sort of happening. There's of course, the film was made by H.C. Weaver, and which was down at what is now Titlow. That's where the studio was. It was the third largest on the West Coast or something before, you know, in the early days of Hollywood, or Hollywoodland at the time, actually. And so there's an effort to kind of bring all that history together, because up until probably 10 or 15 years ago, it had all been lost to history. And slowly, piece by piece, clip by clip, frame by frame, they're finding, oh, these are the bungalows where the stars lived. They're still there. Oh, here's some stills from the movies that they filmed. Oh, we've got little clips of here, of this movie, because that clip was used in a different movie and all that stuff. So they're piecing this sort of Tacoma's film heritage together. And this latest one, Eye of the Totem, is, you know, the cherry on top so far, because this is, again, it's you know, from a local standpoint, you go, oh, look, it's a film of Tacoma and all that sort of thing. But, I mean, it is a movie that was, you know, the Forrest Gump of its time. Yeah. And it is, you know, referred to over and over and over again in, you know, national film history books.
Oh, so it's actually a piece.
It is a large piece.
Well, that's really good for
Tacoma. It is like lost footage of Wizard of Oz.
Whoa. Well, this episode of the podcast has been brought to you by Malarkey's Pool and Brew at 455 Tacoma Avenue South. Come on down. They've got Man Mondays. They've got a special every day of the week on Fridays. Fridays, Saturdays, they have awesome specials. I know they've got prime rib on one of those nights. They've got a buffet, which as long as you're drinking, it's like $1 a plate to go through the buffet. And this is no slouch buffet. It's pretty goddamn delicious. And we're also brought to you by Bill Baker with John L. Scott Realty. Bill Baker's been in the industry for 20-plus years. Right now, if you're looking to buy a house or sell a house, he's the guy to go through. Hit him up at 253-569-6900 or hit him up online at BillBaker@JohnLScott.com. Google him. Find out he's the truth. Really is a good thing. And always check out the Dockyard Derby Dames. The Dockyard Derby Dames are Pierce County's premier roller derby league. Get a hold of them online at DockyardDerbyDames.com. These girls are awesome. And check out roller derby. Anything
pimp,
else?
Pimp your stuff.
Pimp your
give
stuff.
Us, give us your tweeters.
Yeah, how do we stuff. Find out about you?
You can find me on the interwebs. Just Steve Dunkelberger on Facebook or Steve Dunkel at Twitters. Or Reg Red Blacknud backwards if you don't know how to spell.
What did you just say?
Oh, yeah, do that shit again.
Reg Red Blacknud backwards if you want to know how to spell Dunkelberger.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm just Nagorb backwards.
Reg Red Blacknud Nevitz would be Steve Dunkelberger backwards.
You've been listening to the Grit City Podcast. Check them out at gritcitypodcast.com.